The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Coming up on today's program, we're going to be playing the commencement address in its entirety, the address from Sunday night, the 17th commencement address at Herbert W. Armstrong College. I was privileged and honored to be able to give that lecture at the graduation ceremony, the ceremony that was broadcast live over here to Edstone and, of course, back to Edmond, our headquarters campus, as well. So if you missed that, there was a live feed to the ceremony itself on Sunday, but if you missed it, now will be your opportunity to hear what we talked about on Sunday. Well, at the tail end of yesterday's show, we encourage you to get outside and to walk, and I guess in looking at what I've prepared here for this first segment, it may seem contradictory, although it doesn't have to be. You can take a book outside, I suppose, and read as you're walking. I think Joel Hilliker is known for that at the Edmond campus. It's a little harder for me to keep my focus on the lines of the book, but you can certainly go outside and sit down somewhere to study history, study God's Word, study the truth of the Bible. We've had quite a few lectures over the past couple of years, really, quite a lot of admonition to study history ourselves and to help our children to come to love to study history as well. Winston Churchill told an American student back in 1953, he said, study history. In history lie all the secrets of statecraft. He was a man who studied, he practiced what he preached. His study of history, it informed his decisions. It guided his political career. It guided his personal life as well. You can see why it's so important, especially in this day and age, when we're revising history, we're erasing history, we're not interested in history. We've had some really valuable studies that we've gotten into in addition to what the normal curriculum is for Armstrong College. Churchill, I mentioned. John Adams, I think, there at the first part of last year, I believe. Napoleon, earlier this year. More recently, Da Vinci. We've talked a lot about that. We've talked a lot about having the ambition that we need to really pay attention to our studies. There was a great piece at the Federalist a few days ago on how to turn your children into readers for life. This is by a mom. She has small children writing for the Federalist. And so this is impressed on her mind at this particular stage in her life as she's raising those children and wanting them, hoping that they'll really become readers for life. As the title of the article says, it says here, the problem is that as children grow older, the statistical benefits of reading for pleasure become less clear-cut. It's quite easy to raise readers who eventually find that screens are better at providing them utilitarian information and light entertainment. Most children, if you read them books when they're just little toddlers, they love it. They love it when parents read to them. But then as they get older, they find that they can receive more utilitarian information, as she says. And then, of course, all of the distractions of our modern entertainment. She writes, this is a really, really bad thing, but it's so normal, it's hard to realize how dangerous it is. A free country, listen to this. A free country such as ours is dependent on the premise that the citizenry are capable of thinking in a certain way. Yes, we need to have an educated populace. if we're going to hold on to the liberties, especially those of us in America, all the freedoms, certainly in many Western nations, though, it brings to mind what Benjamin Franklin said when one woman asked him what form of government they had drawn up, the founders, and his famous reply was that it was a republic, madam, if you can keep it, if you can hold on to it. In other words, if you descend into ignorance, you're not going to be able to hold on to this gift, this precious gift that is liberty. John Adams, all the founders really echoed these same sentiments. David McCullough, writing about John Adams, said that it was in all a declaration of Adams' faith in education as the bulwark of a good society, the old abiding faith of his Puritan forebears, the survival of the rights and liberties of the people depended on the spread of wisdom, knowledge, and virtue among all people. The common people, it was important for the common people to be educated. Thomas Jefferson thought the same thing. He raised up a college, a university, the University of Virginia. They knew, the founders knew, that an uneducated populace would not keep the republic. They would eventually yield their rights, their freedoms, to a tyrant, to a mob, to an authoritarian. The only way to prevent this, they said, was to spread the knowledge, the wisdom, all across the American nation. This Federalist piece, it says here, they must be able to hold, this is speaking about the importance, remember, of an educated populace. They must be able to hold large ideas in their minds. They must be able to recognize the differences between logic and propaganda. They must possess the self-discipline needed to focus on issues that are boring and seek the wisdom to differentiate between what is right versus what is expedient or amusing. It says, most of all, they must possess the perspective of a true education in ideas so they can think outside the echo chamber of our era. True education, we have a booklet that goes by that title. What is true education? Jesus said, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We have to know it. We have to study it. And this at a time when, as so many other prophetic passages bring out, people are turning their ears away from the truth. Peter said that they're willingly ignorant of the word of God, ignorant of God's truth. The prophet Isaiah said that they prefer smooth things. They just want to hear what's nice, whatever it is that will tickle the ears. Listen to what Paul said to Timothy. He said, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. They're not going to endure sound doctrine. It says in verse 4, this is 2 Timothy 4 in verse 4, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. They're going to turn away from the truth. They're going to turn away from the Bible. And instead, they'll believe fables. They'll accept lies. This Federalist piece, it says here that we all need each other to be readers. Here she talks about the importance of, well, hungering for knowledge and truth yourself as a parent. And then later on, she gets into the importance of that example for the children's sake. She writes, all of this is deeply connected to what and how we read. It's not that people who use their phones frequently are necessarily dumber than people who don't. Like any tool, though, screens can be dangerous. They can fill the spare moments of life until no time is left for thought or deep learning. She's talking here about something that we've addressed quite often on this program, just reducing the screen time so that you can devote more time to thought, to concentration, meditation, and deep learning. She says these gadgets, they can retrain our brains and make it hard to focus on a long-form conversation, whether in person or in print. If you look around at our society today, you don't see a lot of long-form conversation, especially in America. I think maybe you see a little more of it here in the UK. But if you think about what reading actually is, delving into a biography or a good history book, that's a long-form conversation. That's a conversation that goes on for some time, for many days, maybe weeks if it's a big book. Books are one of the best ways to guard our minds against the misuse of screens, she writes. Books aren't magical mind vitamins, of course, yet in order to cultivate the ability to think, we must engage with good, wise, and true thoughts. And it happens that the works of humanity's greatest thinkers are found in books. They're found in books. These are of course, we take them for granted today because millions and millions and millions of them are printed every year, and who knows how many titles there are. Solomon said of the making of many books, there's no end. Ever since the printing press, books are everywhere now. But still, even still, you have people that, if they're really interested in this, they collect a large number of books. They build up a pretty good-sized library. You don't see that so often with the audio or videos. I guess some people have a video library still. Most of that's now online. But how many things do you see or observe on TV, even if it's a quality program, that you say, well, I need to collect this and make sure I hold on to it? I guess it's not the best example in the world because so much of that is so easily accessible. But still, you do have people that fill their shelves with books that have changed their lives. It says the works of humanity's greatest thinkers are found in books. Think of how the Bible was put together with 40 authors over the course of, what was it, 1,600 years, I think the correspondence course says. And then you think about the centuries that followed the canonization of the New Testament and how many people actually sacrificed their lives to make sure that the Bible was distributed, to hold on to their copies of the Bible. Matthew 4 and verse 4, it says that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. The Holy Bible is God's word in print. We have these precious words. We have these good and wise and true thoughts. And every day we want to engage. We want to have a long-form conversation, whether it's our Bible study or the study of history. Paul said to Timothy, I brought this out in the program at the end of last week, about seeking wonderful counsel from God. That verse in 1 Timothy 4 where he says that we ought to be nourished up in the words of faith and of good doctrine, whereunto you have attained. Feed on these precious words. Feed on this truth, this good doctrine. And then in verse 13, he said to Timothy, until I come, give attendance to reading, exhortation, and doctrine. Make sure that you're studying your books. He said elsewhere in the book, set the right example. Don't neglect the gift that you've been given to speak, to teach these things. But of course, to be a fine teacher, he had to give attendance to reading. This Federalist piece, it says here, books liberate us from the isolation of our 2019 bubble. The beautiful thing is that they are also tremendously helpful at helping us to develop the attention span that we need to think deeply. she goes on to point out how important this is if you're a Christian, if you're a follower of Christ, how important it is to study and to think deeply and to have these long-form conversations. Speaking of Paul writing to Timothy, it says in 2 Timothy 2:15, it says, "Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that needs not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth." Study to show yourself approved to God. God is the master. We're the disciples. We want to get a passing grade. We want God's approval. We're not doing this to seek the approval of men. We want to know. You shall know the truth. And the truth will set you free. How could we ever come to understand God's truth or God's will if we didn't study, if we didn't have a love for the Bible, for Bible history, for Bible doctrine? She says here in this Federalist piece, here's the part about just setting an example for our children. It says, find a book for yourself and read it. How does one convince children to love books? Nothing is so ineffective as preaching the merits of something you don't do. At the beginning of her article, by the way, she referred to this meme on the internet where this woman's on a park bench with her little daughter, and she's sitting next to another woman who's on a park bench with her daughter. And the latter couple, the mom's reading a book, and then the daughter's reading a book. But this mom, who's on her phone, and her daughter's on her phone, she says to the mother reading a book, how do you get your children to read a book? How do you get them interested in reading? And of course, the point of it is that she's doing it as the parent. She loves it. And the child sees that example. It says here in the Federalist, the good news is that children are incredibly open to things they see you enjoy. If they see you enjoy it, well, then they want to experience it. You are their example of what it means to be an adult. Besides, don't you want a fuller life? Reading good stuff is a blast. This is fun, she says. This is real entertainment. It's edifying. It's nourishing. Now, you have Paul giving these instructions to Timothy, saying, until I come, make sure you're reading and studying. But like I brought out in that wonderful council lecture, he also set the example, Paul did. Remember at the end of 2 Timothy 4, where he told Timothy, when you come, you know, if you're able to get here, bring the books. This was Paul right at the end of his life while in prison, and he wanted his library. As I said last week or the week before, I forget which, we don't often think enough about just how diligent these individuals of the Bible were with their study, their meditation, their prayer, the time that they spent alone with God in a long conversation. Paul set the example for Timothy. That's why he said in 1 Corinthians 11, "Be you followers of me, even as I also am of Christ." He set the example, and the brethren followed in his steps. In the Federalist piece, it says, it's easy for busy parents to think that we don't have time for reading. However, that's usually not true. We usually find time for the little refreshments we think are a normal part of life, even if it's just social media, a night out, or a coffee break. Rightly so, it says. We all need mental, emotional, and spiritual rest. It says one of the best ways to achieve that is to provide our minds, feelings, and souls beautiful words and ideas. We all need nourishment. Basically, that's what she's saying. And we make time. We find time for other little things. It says the real obstacle is building the habit. We've just got to get into the habit. That takes planning and a period of self-discipline. But it doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to take hours and hours of time. Seriously, you could read while you brush your teeth. Well, I usually like to get into it a little bit more than that. But still, you can listen. I certainly do listen to audio. while I'm brushing my teeth or other things like that. We had a ladies' night not that long ago, a couple of weeks ago, where this was discussed in the question and answers session. And someone commented on about just how over this summer that's now ahead of us, that he wanted to take advantage of his time and manage his time better. And he pointed out that just taking advantage of those little pockets of time that we have every day, this is something that Ernest Dimne brings out in his book, The Art of Thinking, that classic from, I think, back in the 1930s. Learn to value those spare moments that you have when you're waiting for a ride or waiting for a meeting or walking to work or taking a break in the middle of the day, or a few moments or minutes maybe at the end of the lunch hour. This author says here, good books will make you want more. A huge part of making this work is finding books you want to read. This is really the last main point that she makes. Setting the example, as we just covered, but then also you've got to get into books that you'll get really excited about, books that you love. Find books that you want to read. She says, if you're ready to embark on a structured course of study and are seeking detailed guidance, you might check out Susan Wise Bowers, The Well-Educated Man. She also plugs Mortimer Adler's book, How to Read a Book. That's from way back as well. He wrote that decades ago. He's no longer around. But a powerful little book. I read it, I think, 20 years ago, and my son just got through it a few months ago, and it was great to see the next generation. I remember that book really impacting me and my thinking and my approach to reading and marking a book. And we really want to try to help our children experience some of those same breakthroughs. They need it now more than ever. The distractions today, as compared to when I was a teenager, just looking back a generation ago, now more than ever, we need to turn off the distractions and really making sure that we're delving into those long-form conversations. Her conclusion here, it says, our goal is to build, well, this is the last point, actually, where she encourages you to do something with what you read. She says, our goal is to build a life of thought and learning. That means this reading thing must be a long-term endeavor. Further on, most of us find it easier to value work when we can see tangible results. I think this is a really important point to make. And it's easier for someone, let's say, like with me reading, I'm usually reading something with the thought of preparing a segment or giving a lecture on it or helping the students with this or that, or now we have the book club. And so that's a really wonderful bit of incentive there to think that, well, what I'm doing with this book or this study, it's really helpful. It's really going to go toward, I'm going to see some tangible results. She says, it's helpful to do something when you finish a book, discussing it with friends. So how do you do that if you're not getting on the radio every day or if you're not teaching a forum at college? Well, she says, you can discuss it with friends. That's a good option. Simply keeping a reading journal, keeping a notebook so that you can jot down some of the best ideas and thoughts from that study. You can do this online with Goodreads. There's a few people here at Edstone that are in a Goodreads book or club, I guess, online, where you keep track of what you're reading and you give little reviews after you're done. Keep a reading journal, she says. It's quite satisfying to look back at a given year and to see what you've read and what you thought of it. She says, finally, we all want to be the parent of the kid who reads. Far more important, though, is giving our child a parent who not only reads books, but allows books to shape and transform our minds and souls. It's the best way out of America's parental rat race, she says. It's also a beautiful way to live. So just remember some of those points that she brings out. Setting the example, finding books that are really good and that you'll love, doing something with what you read. There's lots of opportunities for this Even at the trumpet.com website with the book club section and just some of the other lectures and things that we've given on radio and with some of our college classes. It's such a crucial part, a crucial component to our education. Education is salvation, or rather the other way around. Salvation is a process of education. And that's what you'll hear coming up in the commencement address in the next segment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send us a message to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll conclude today's show with the commencement address from Sunday night. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible, the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends, and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. What it will be like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Greetings to everyone at both campuses, Herbert W. Armstrong College. Greetings to our chancellor back in Edmond, all of the ministers and faculty present at both locations. Of course, the graduates, the alumni. We have lots of family, special guests, visitors, lots of distinguished guests. So this truly is a special ceremony that we're able to enjoy every year, and it's an honor to be a part of this, the 17th graduation ceremony at Armstrong College. This year, of course, we congratulate the class of 2019. That's exciting. Several years ago, there was a New York Times columnist who lamented the glaring deficiencies that he saw in higher education. He said, for example, that there are no college courses in proper mate selection, for one, and that they don't have courses on how to make and keep friends. So essentially what he was saying is that, well, you might go off to college and learn how to make a living. It doesn't really teach you how to live. Now, Herbert W. Armstrong, as we know, established God's College on the foundation of the Word of God. The Holy Bible, and the Bible, as Mr. Armstrong often said, it's like our Maker's instruction book or the manual that he sends along with his creation. And we know, and we're taught at all of these classes at Armstrong College, maybe some more than other, but the foundation is there with all of them. We're taught how to live from our how-to manual. I thought it was interesting as I was just going over some of those statements from that that column years ago and thinking back to principles of living. I didn't teach that this year, but over the years I've taught it maybe 10 or 11 times. And I went back to the first set of notes, the course outline that we hand out, the very first paragraph that the freshmen, these are incoming freshmen, 18-year-olds, and this is Freshman Bible, together with Life and Teachings, I guess the other Bible class for freshmen. It's mandatory. Everybody attends. And this is what it says. This is the course outline. It says Principles of Living examines human sexuality, dating, and mate selection from a theological perspective. It says this knowledge lays a firm foundation for the God-ordained marriage and family relationship. It says in a broader sense, God's perspective is what's missing from knowledge in general. Therefore, in addition to laying the groundwork for the family relationship, Principles of Living will serve as a guide for the student's pursuit of true education, learning how to live. So this is one of the very first things that freshmen are taught coming into this college. This is really what you could say this is AC's specialty. We, of course, talk about the more general liberal arts education. But if there is one specialty training that you get at this college, it's in this foundation of how to live. Tonight, or today, I just want to remind you graduates, and really all of us, I want to remind us, and you heard it even from our president's our student body president's address earlier, I just want to remind us that this commencement ceremony, it really is just a beginning. He brought out how it was a launch as well, and that's an exciting way to look at it, because we really are taking off. When you leave college, all of you, when you think about how to live, how to build a marriage and family, so all of our graduates, you're not yet married, you don't yet have a family, so there's a lot of work yet to be done. There's a lot of building yet to do. It's a privilege and honor to come to God's college and to receive such a solid foundation. And it is something so wonderful that we can build upon. But as I say, you're going to go away from college as a graduate knowing, hopefully, that there's so much more to build. If you think about it just for a moment, most of the things that you learn in life, if you look at your life from start to finish, most of what you learn over the course of that life is going to be learned outside of a classroom. Classroom instruction has its place, and it is important, and we do need it. And even in God's church, we come and assemble at services to receive instruction. But think about how much more we learn on the job or with practical hands-on experience. And then think about, of course, the spiritual dimension to all of this. Mr. Armstrong often said that salvation is education. And so it's a process. It's a process that never truly does end. It just continues right on into God's kingdom. And so education is something that we pursue after, not just while we're at college. It's a lifelong pursuit. It's a lifelong endeavor, true education. Salvation is education. Think about all the things that you're going to be doing, as I say, after graduation. Mr. Armstrong had that classic quote, remember, in the autobiography about education comes from this, from study, from experience, from travel, from thinking about what you see and experience. It comes from contacts, people that you meet. Obviously, it's going to come from your job experience. It's going to come from practical hands-on experience with marriage and family. And so the education, the training, it continues. Tonight, I just want to, if I have enough time, hopefully I can get through three simple points. I know we don't usually take notes at graduation, but we'll probably have this posted at some point later if you'd like to go back and review these three simple points. On going forward and commencing with your continuing education, it really is something that you should see as an assignment. Your assignment, if you choose to accept it, your assignment is to go on from here and to grow, as it says in 2 Peter 3:18, to grow in learning and understanding and wisdom, to build, as I say, to build for God. The first point, and this is brought out in an article my father wrote back in 2015, it's to become totally teachable before God. He wrote in that Trumpet magazine back in 2015 about the greatest lesson that Steve Jobs learned. Steve Jobs, of course, you're familiar with him and what he did with Apple. But in this little article, my father talks about a couple of biographies about Steve Jobs and how that in the case of one biographer, he kind of divided his life into three acts. And it was in the second act that he had a lot of setbacks and failures. And my father brought out the point that in that second act of his life, he really became more humble and teachable. And that led to the greatest act or phase of his life, when he really took Apple to where we see it today. There's a verse in Isaiah 66 that talks about God looking to those who are humble and contrite, who tremble before God's word. This is the sort of attitude that we have to have if we're going to be able to be taught by God. Another verse I just went through recently for a program. This is Jeremiah 10 and verse 23, where the prophet says, "O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It's not in man that walks to direct his steps." So imagine going off to a college and learning that lesson, that it's not in man to direct his steps. We need help. We need help as a college student, and you need it as a graduate. You need it as an adult. You need it as an elderly individual in God's church. We need guidance and direction from God every day. Isaiah 55 talks about just how this vast difference between the thinking of God and then our thoughts. We have to appeal to God daily and go to Him. That same passage in Jeremiah, by the way, it talks about praying for God to correct us, to correct our steps, to correct our ways, so that we can know the way to go. That's a valuable lesson, and hopefully you're beginning to learn that. You students, you've gone through this experience 2 and 4 years, and hopefully this really is beginning to sink in. This is one big takeaway from the college experience, that we don't know. We don't know the way, but God will show us. I won't take the time to go through more verses in Proverbs 3, but that section there speaks about how easy it is to just lean to your own understanding instead of entrusting God. It's natural. It comes natural to lean to your own understanding. You come to college, you get that outline for principles of living, and hopefully you come to understand right away that I'm here for God to show me, to help me see the way to go. It was brought out earlier tonight. Why the college is here. How much it's needed to support the work. Why Mr. Armstrong established it back in 1947. That's a fundamental lesson if we're going to continue with our education beyond this commencement. The second point that I'll touch on briefly is to cultivate a spirit of curiosity. Mr. Armstrong, again, he's a good example with any of these lessons. But when you think about the way that he was, he brings this out in the autobiography, just how much he craved understanding, and he would pester his dad and ask him how things worked, and he was always trying to understand why this happened or why this was going on. And his father teased him, saying that he thought he was going to be a Philadelphia lawyer because he was always asking so many questions. A lot of children do that, but we tend to lose that curiosity as we get older and we take things for granted, or we hear, you know, a short answer from a parent or a guardian that just says, "I don't know, it's just that way, forget about it." Instead of someone that takes the time to answer and to help us come to understand. Listen to what Mr. Armstrong said. He follows this story about when he was 5, he was asking all of these questions, and then he makes this point. "The obsession for understanding was to have great influence on founding the Plain Truth magazine and Ambassador College in later years." So it just sprung from that same attitude or mindset that he had as a little kid, a little child. "I wanted to know why." And then he says this obsession, think about it, an obsession to understand. That's what led to the creation of the Plain Truth. Ambassador College, his education never stopped. Mr. Armstrong, he continued right up to 93. He was writing Mystery of the Ages. Now that's someone that had a passionate obsession for knowledge and understanding and wisdom. What an example. And you think about Mystery of the Ages and all of those wonderful questions that are addressed in that book. My father's talked about who and what is God being the greatest question there is. But look at where it all started. It goes back to when he was just a little boy and he wanted to understand and know. And then when God started to work on his mind later in life, he took that same approach. He wanted to know. He wanted to understand. He was intensely curious about God's truth and God's way of life. This year is the 500-year anniversary of Leonardo da Vinci's death, and so there's lots of exhibits throughout the UK and in Europe, in France, at the Louvre, at Buckingham Palace later this month. And so they're putting a lot of da Vinci's drawings and paintings on display. And it's been interesting just reading a little bit about his passion for learning. This is someone that didn't understand God's truth. But he really did have a curiosity, an intense curiosity. He didn't have the university education of his day. He did benefit from a few mentors. But outside of that, his remarkable education, and it really is in a strictly worldly sense, his remarkable education, it just sprung from the fact that he was interested in just about everything. He had a passionate interest in things. He really wanted to learn. An insatiable hunger for knowledge. He had it. He had it. He saw himself, it's interesting, we all see him as a painter, but he saw himself more as an engineer or an architect. There's a funny point brought out in a book on him that when he was applying for a job, he was sending his resume or his job description, and he emphasized all of these points about architecture and an engineer, and he wanted to do this, that, and the other. And then at the end of his application, he says, oh, and by the way, I paint as well. It was words to that effect. So he was also a painter, and there's lots of scholars and historians that actually look at his life, and you know, they're frustrated because he spent so much time in these other pursuits, but they think, well, if he just would have painted more, we'd have even more of his glorious paintings. But those other pursuits did factor in to his brilliance with the brush. There's this line in his notebooks, his journal, where he had a journal entry saying, it was like a to-do list, I guess. He said he wanted to describe the tongue of a woodpecker, which is kind of an interesting desire to have. But if you look at, we've had articles in some of the church literature about a woodpecker and just the design of its beak and its skull and the tail and the way that it's able to latch on to the side of a hickory oak and then just start pounding away. I don't know. I think it pounds into an oak tree, for example, sometimes 100 pounds per minute. That's phenomenal. I don't know if you've ever tried to bash your head against a tree 100 times, but you would sustain some serious head trauma from that. But when you look at the way the beak is constructed and the skull and then the tissue, the sponge-like tissue that you have surrounding the brain, and then as is brought out in this Isaacson biography about Da Vinci, the tongue is the most fascinating member in this marvelous little creation of God. It's about three times the length of the beak, and of course the beak is sharp and long as well, and so it's like a hammer hammering away, drilling that hole, and then the tongue comes out three times as long, and it's kind of a sticky substance that goes right down to where these grub worms are or ants or whatever. Ants mistake it for being a worm, an intruder, so they basically rush the worm. And then they land on this sticky tongue, and it's just easy pickings for this woodpecker. But the most fascinating thing about it is that when the tongue is pulled back inside of the beak, it doesn't fit in there because it's so long. It actually wraps around the brain to serve as more cushion. It's like it's a helmet. It serves as a helmet for the woodpecker, and it's also its weapon to get all of those ants. And this is something, as I was reading through that, you think of Romans 1 and verse 20, and how that the creation, God's creation, it proves his existence. It proves his power, his creativity. Forget about Da Vinci's creativity for a moment, but think of the creativity of God himself, the great creator God. All the things that we can see, the material things that make the invisible real and obvious, so obvious, that nothing like that could have just evolved over the course of millions and millions of years. How bizarre it would be to think that you could somehow go from, you know, a nice little bird who's not a woodpecker to then a woodpecker, and it somehow evolved or transitioned over time. But going back to Da Vinci, Mr. Armstrong, some of these examples, my father wrote this or said this in those meditation tapes years ago. He said, great minds seem to all have one common trait among them. They seem to have an interest in everything, and not only just a passing interest, but an intense interest in just about everything. He says, I think that's a common trait of all great men or great minds. They have this intense curiosity. Someone said about Da Vinci that he surely was the most curious human being in history. The way that in his notebooks, I think, bring this out. But it's important for us to maintain that curiosity and to have that hunger for learning. The Bible talks about hungering for God's truth, God's righteousness. My father's gone through Jeremiah 1 and that section where it says to Jeremiah, it's back and forth between him and God says to him, Jeremiah, what do you see? What are you observing? And he had to be detailed, and he was detailed. Read Jeremiah 1. So he was observant to these visions that God was giving to him. There's a lot to be gleaned from being curious, observing God's creation, just observing events around us, being observant to what's happening in God's work with respect to the creation. I mentioned Romans 1:20, but Psalm 19 talks about the heavens declaring the glory of God. So much can be learned from that. One final point to make, and this springs from Matthew 5 and verse 48. A memory verse, the one that says, become you therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Matthew 5 and verse 48. And the third point I'll leave you with is to aim for perfection. As you go forward, you're certainly not there yet. None of us are. But that is where we're headed. God is reproducing himself. God is reproducing his character and his nature. And so we have to aim high. My father said years ago that there are no accidental masterpieces. It doesn't just happen. We don't stumble upon a masterpiece. The masterpiece is made by a lot of detailed, diligent labor and effort. I mentioned the other night with our book club that when Da Vinci set out to work on his masterpiece, the Mona Lisa, he started that in 1503, and he continued it on and off for the next 14 years. He basically had three paintings that he just kept with him for the last 15, 16 years of his life. These were his babies. These were the paintings that he cherished. One of them was Lisa, the Mona Lisa. And if you look at that painting, it's really mesmerizing. And you can see a lifetime of intense curiosity and interest in a lot of different subjects that come out as a result of that painting, or you see it rather in that painting. National Geographic had an article in 2017 that said, the Mona Lisa's smile is the culmination of a lifetime spent studying art, science, optics, and every other possible field that he could apply his curiosity to, including understanding the universe and how we fit into it. Well, he didn't quite understand our purpose for being, but he loved nature. And you look at the background of the Mona Lisa, or you look at the way that she's smiling, or you look at her eyes, you look at the lighting. He studied all of those things. He dissected 30 human bodies over the course of his life. When he got a job to sculpt a horse, he immediately set out to go dissect a horse, because he had to know how the muscles, how the tendons, how everything was underneath the skin. He had to know what was going on outside and inside That's some kind of detail. To be on someone's deathbed waiting for him to die so that you could begin cutting him open. That's how, and then you look at his notebooks and the drawings of all of these muscles and bones, and this was back in the 1500s, even earlier than that. That's someone who's really curious about a lot of things. In Walter Isaacson's biography, he said, "What about all the scholars and critics over the years who despaired that Leonardo squandered too much time immersed in studying optics and anatomy and the patterns of the cosmos?" He says, "The Mona Lisa answers them with a smile. It all factored in. It all contributed to his masterpiece. God is producing masterpieces of his own. He's reproducing himself, as I said earlier. I want to leave you with a quote. This is from Mystery of the Ages. To just think about this and put it on the spiritual plane. The fact that God's, of course, we have to be willing. It's God doing the creation, but we have to be willing. We have to let him create. We have to let him shape us and mold us into a perfect God being. He says here, this is Mystery of the Ages, human life is at once of infinitesimally less value than they suppose, the scholars, he says, and at the same time of supremely greater potential than they know. You don't learn this in the colleges and universities of today. You go to those universities and they tell you how great human beings are. If they only knew, Mr. Armstrong says, it's of less value than they suppose, but it's the potential that we need to be focusing on. What God is creating. He says, what is the real truth concerning human worth? What is the real value of a human life? He says, it's grossly overestimated in its own reality and astoundingly undervalued in its supreme potential. The truth is indeed staggering. If we'll submit to God's will, going back to that first point, and really let him guide and direct our steps, think about where it's taking us. Think about where this is leading. We want to keep that big picture in mind as we go on from this launch. And as we do also, just think about how much God's work needs our students, our graduates, our young people, our young couples, our young families. Think about how much the work needs your youth, your energy, your curiosity, your enthusiasm, your excitement for God's way of life. It's very important. It's a wonderful blessing to receive what you've received here at college for these 2 or 4 years. But now, as your student body president told you earlier, now the true test is upon you.